I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. Is Democracy Now!
The residents of Khartoum woke up to heavy sounds of gunfire, explosions, and then we found out that it's not restricted to one area. This was happening all over the city, the tri-state area, Khartoum, Durban, Bahri. And then we found out that this is actually happening in other cities around Sudan, where the rapid support forces and the Sudanese armed forces have erupted in conflicts.
Nearly 100 civilians have been killed in Sudan in heavy fighting between the Sudanese military and rival paramilitary force. Could this lead to civil war? We'll go to Khartoum for the latest. Then to a leading Ugandan LGBTQ activist who's risking his life by traveling to the United States to speak out against a recently passed bill in Uganda that criminalizes anyone identifying as LGBTQ.
This interview that I'm having now, if I had it in Uganda, the studio, the entity, myself, would be criminalized. This legislation is here to erase the entire livelihood of the LGBTQ person in Uganda.
And then, not too late, changing the climate story from despair to possibility. We'll speak to longtime Filipino climate campaigner Red Constantino and the award-winning writer and activist Rebecca Solnit.
We can sort of leave the age in which fossil fuel politics, which have been so grotesquely corrupt, as we, you know, observe the 20th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq by the U.S. government. But also a lot of, you know, we don't just have to change the energy system. We have to change the culture. I think we have to change what we value, how we measure wealth.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Sudan is roiling from a third day of violence that's killed nearly 100 civilians and injured hundreds more since Saturday, as rival leaders of Sudan's military government battle for control of the Northeast African nation. There are reports of heavy artillery fire in the capital, Khartoum, explosions at Khartoum's main airport, airstrikes on military barracks and bases in cities and regions across Sudan. The violence pits two factions of Sudan's military establishment against one another. One is led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, who's been the de facto leader of Sudan since the overthrow of longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir in April 2019. The other faction is led by Lieutenant General Mohamed Hamdan, known as Hameti, the former commander of the Janjaweed militias responsible for murders, rapes and torture in Sudan. Darfur region. The World Food Program has halted all operations in Sudan after three of its employees were killed and a UN humanitarian aircraft damaged at Khartoum's main airport. The United Nations, the African Union, the United States, Russia and China are all calling for a ceasefire in Sudan. The African Union's Peace and Security Council has warned against external interference. The fighting has dashed hopes of a civilian-led, democratically elected government, a key demand of protesters who led the mass mobilizations in 2019. That led to al-Bashir's ouster. After headlines, we'll go to Khartoum for the latest. The U.S. Supreme Court Friday temporarily restored access to the abortion pill mifepristone, but only until Wednesday, in order to further review a lower court decision which banned the country's most popular abortion method just one week earlier. Meanwhile, The Washington Post reported Matthew Kaczmarek, the conservative Trump-appointed judge who issued the ban on mifepristone, removed his name as the author of an anti-abortion and anti-trans law review article and did not disclose the article to the Senate Judiciary Committee as he was going through the judicial nomination process. Rallies to defend abortion rights took place across the United States this weekend. Colorado's Democratic Governor Jared Polis has signed three bills into law protecting access to abortion and gender-affirming care, upholding what he called Colorado's reputation as a beacon of freedom and choice. Among other things, the measures shield people who receive provider assistance abortions or gender-affirming care from criminal prosecution or lawsuits in other states where they are outlawed. In Ukraine, a Russian missile attack on a residential neighborhood in the eastern city of Slovyansk killed at least 11 people Friday. This comes as Ukraine says the bloody battle for control of Bakhmut has reached unprecedented intensity. In Russia, the prominent opposition figure, Vladimir Kara-Murza, has been sentenced to 25 years in prison for treason for condemning Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine. The Russian-British former politician helped make the case for Western governments to sanction Russian officials and said his country was committing war crimes. In a statement last week, Kara-Murza said, quote, "I know the day will come when the darkness engulfing our country will clear, our society will open its eyes and shudder when it realizes what crimes were committed in its name," he said. Meanwhile, the Brazilian president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, said he is working on forming a group of leaders that, quote, prefer to talk about peace rather than war in hopes of ending the conflict through diplomatic means.
President Putin does not take the initiative to stop. Zelensky does not take the initiative to stop. Europe and the United States contribute to the continuation of this war. I think we need to sit at a table and say, that's enough. Let's start talking, because war never brought and will never bring any benefit to humanity.
President Lula, who was speaking from Abu Dhabi, said he discussed joint mediation efforts with the United Arab Emirates as well as China, which he visited last week. In China, Lula also focused on rebuilding Brazil's diplomatic relationship with Beijing and agreed to expand cooperation on trade, technology, and other areas. In India, two high-profile politicians were shot and killed on live television Saturday while in police custody in the northern city of Prayagraj. Atiq Ahmed, an organized crime leader who also served in India's parliament, was shot in the head, as was his brother Ashraf Ahmed, a former legislator in Uttar Pradesh state. At the time of the murders, the brothers were being escorted in handcuffs to a hospital for a medical checkup. The assassins were swiftly arrested by police.
According to primary information, three men came posing as media personnel and started firing. Three people have now been arrested and they are being interrogated. And Atiq and Ashraf died in this incident.
Both victims were from India's Muslim minority. One of the assassins was recorded chanting a slogan popularized by Hindu nationalists and anti-Muslim campaigns. French President Emmanuel Macron has signed into law a hotly contested retirement overhaul, which raises the retirement age from 62 to 64 years old and extends the years of work required to receive a full pension to 43 years. The Constitutional Council on Friday ruled in favor of the measure after Macron and his party had to force it through by executive action, given its widespread unpopularity, including among lawmakers. Protests continue as union leaders seek to ramp up the pressure on Macron.
For 3 months, there have been extremely important strikes, demonstrations, and our determination is not weakened. This will relaunch the mobilization this evening. For the first time since the end of the Second World War, unions jointly call on all employees to massively demonstrate on May 1st to win the withdrawal of this reform.
In Japan, members of the G7 have vowed to speed up the phase-out of fossil fuels and the transition to renewable energy, aiming to reach net zero emissions by 2050 by boosting solar power and offshore wind capacity. But the group of ministers could not collectively agree to a 2030 deadline for phasing out coal, a goal pushed by Canada and other members. The group also refused to cut off investments in gas. Elsewhere in Japan, the foreign ministers of G7 nations are convening for 3 days of meetings to discuss the Ukraine war, China, and North Korea. Protesters gathered near the train station in the resort town of Karuizawa as officials arrived on Sunday.
The objective of G7 to hold talks only among developed countries in the first place is questionable. I have doubts about the purpose for them to have a meal together to talk about the opinions of poor countries and the countries that are currently at war.
World leaders will meet in Hiroshima next month for the official G7 summit. Back in the United States, in Georgia, over 600 prisoners are being transferred from the Fulton County Jail after the family of a dead prisoner says he was eaten alive by insects and bedbugs in his cell last year. The family of 35-year-old LaShawn Thompson, who is being held in the jail's psychiatric wing, is demanding a criminal investigation and that the jail be shut down. The U.S. marked another deadly weekend of gun violence in the small town of Dadeville, Alabama. A shooter opened fire in a room full of teenagers celebrating a sweet 16 birthday party, killing 4 people and injuring 28 others. Among the dead was the star student athlete, Phil Dowdell, who was remembered by a coach and teacher at his high school.
Great student athlete. You know, not only did he win... Not only did he win the 100 and 200 last year, but, you know, he set goals to be able to play and to be able to win that. And just he's so goal-oriented, always had a smile on his face, just willing to help anybody.
Elsewhere, a shooter opened fire on a crowd of hundreds in a park in Louisville, Kentucky, killing 2. This came as Louisville is still reeling from the mass shooting at a bank last Monday that claimed 5 lives. A shooting in West Oahu, Hawaii, left 2 people dead Friday. Meanwhile, in Kansas City, Missouri, a black teenager was shot and hospitalized after accidentally ringing the wrong doorbell while trying to pick up his siblings. And in Nashville, a 7-month pregnant woman was rushed to the hospital last week where she had an emergency C-section after she was shot by a Walgreens employee who said he suspected her of shoplifting. The employee claimed self-defense even though he followed her into the store's parking lot where he opened fire. In Indianapolis, top Republican hopefuls for the 2024 presidential nomination joined the 3-day annual meeting of the National Rifle Association over the weekend. Headlining the event was Donald Trump, who received a 2-minute standing ovation before declaring himself the most pro-gun, pro-Second Amendment president in U.S. history.
With me at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, no one will lay a finger on your firearms, just as took place for 4 years when I was your president. I will also create a new tax credit to reimburse any teacher for the full cost of a concealed carry firearm and training from highly qualified experts.
And in New Jersey, faculty at the state-run Rutgers University have suspended their strike and are returning to classrooms today after reaching tentative deals on pay increases, job security and union representation. These include a 48% raise for adjunct faculty, 33% raise for graduate workers. The first faculty strike in Rutgers' 257-year history was organized by 3 unions representing over 9,000 professors, lecturers, graduate assistants and researchers. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations, the African Union, the United States, Russia, and China are all calling for a ceasefire in Sudan after fighting between the Sudanese military and a rival paramilitary force have left nearly 100 civilians dead since Saturday. Hundreds of civilians have been injured. The actual death toll is believed to be much higher. The heaviest fighting has been in the capital, Khartoum, around the Republican Palace, the army headquarters, and the international airport. The fighting's pitted Sudan's military, led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, against a powerful paramilitary group called the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, led by Lieutenant General Mohamed Hamdan, known as Hemeti. General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan has been the de facto leader of Sudan since the overthrow of the longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir in April 2019. Mohamed Hamdan is a former commander of the Janjaweed militias, which was responsible for murders, rapes and torture in Sudan's Darfur region. The fighting's dashed hopes of a civilian-led, democratically elected government, a key demand of protesters who led the mass mobilizations 4 years ago that led to al-Bashir's ouster. The fighting stems in part from a dispute over how the paramilitary rapid support forces would be integrated into the Sudanese military. The deadly clashes have also impacted humanitarian efforts in Sudan. In North Darfur, three employees of the World Food Program were killed, forcing the UN agency to temporarily halt all operations in Sudan. In addition, a UN humanitarian plane was significantly damaged at Sudan's airport in Khartoum on Sunday. We go now to Khartoum, where we're joined by the Sudanese activist Maureen Al-Neil. We welcome you back to Democracy Now!, Maureen. Can you explain what's happening in your city, in the capital of Sudan, in Khartoum?
Good morning, Amy Goodman. As I'm speaking to you right now from Khartoum, we're hearing airstrikes. We're hearing fighter jets. We're hearing different kinds of explosions that we're not aware what are they exactly. I think what is not clear when we're saying, when in the international media, we're talking about the clashes being around the military headquarters, around the presidential palace, and around other military buildings, that these buildings are in the middle of the city, very close by to residential areas, not meters away from any of these buildings. There are neighborhoods that are populous. There are many residents living there, and these clashes are happening in between these buildings. The people, the civilians, are caught in the middle of the clashes and are being affected. And the casualties, as you said, are probably much higher than reported because people are not able to reach hospitals. We're not able to reach medical attention. Many have been shot on their ways to hospitals and medical attention, and the streets are not safe. The ceasefire that was announced yesterday had absolutely no manifestation on the ground, and I think the Sudanese people were aware of that. The rapid support forces, the Sudanese armed forces, and the UN, all the parties that were announcing this ceasefire or the truce that were supposed to provide safe routes, are not credible for the Sudanese people. And it was shown to us when 4 p.m. came, the time for the truce, actually the explosions were louder. There were many more gunfires that were being heard by residents of Khartoum. And people were frantically trying to warn each other to not believe the ceasefire, to not go out of their houses, to stay sheltering in place.
I am so sorry you're speaking to us under such duress. I wanted to play for you Sudan's former Prime Minister, Abdalla Hamdok, urging warring parties to reach a ceasefire.
I speak to you today as our country faces the danger of separation, and I say to you that when a bullet is fired from a weapon, it cannot tell the difference between the attacker and those being attacked, and the victims are the Sudanese people. My first message is to General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and the leaders of the Sudanese military, and to Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo and the leaders of the rapid support forces. The exchange of fire must stop immediately, and the voice of reason must rule. Everyone will lose, and there is no victory when it is on the top of the bodies of our people.
Now, he's the former prime minister for a very brief period of time. But for people who are not understanding this conflict and what happened after Bashir was thrown out in April of 2019, go back in time and explain how what we're seeing today is unfolding, Maureen.
The 2019 Popular Revolution ousted President Omar al-Bashir, and immediately the military took over, and the political powers at the time, the Forces of Freedom and Change, immediately entered in negotiation with the military, causing a lot of frustration amongst the people who have given their lives and souls to the revolution, as we knew that these negotiations do not meet our demands. We did not want to enter into negotiations. We wanted an immediate exit from the power when it comes to the military. And we wanted an immediate transition of power to a civilian government. However, the negotiations are what led us to this moment, and we hear statements such as the one that we just heard from former Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok. We hear them with a lot of frustration because this is the transitional government that, when was in power, empowered the Sudanese armed forces and empowered the rapid support forces and further legitimized them. And this is what led us to a situation of a full-blown conflict.
So on Sunday, Sudan's fighting factions agreed to a three-hour humanitarian pause from 4 to 7 in the afternoon. Did that actually happen? That's simply an indication of what could happen. And talk about all the different countries that are now weighing in, if that matters.
The truce did not manifest on the ground at all. There was continuous airstrikes and gunshots and explosions being heard by people sheltering in place. And we did not think it was credible. We did not think it was going to happen. And they proved us right, that they are not serious about this truce, the same way that they are not serious in their interest for the well-being of the Sudanese people. As for the foreign entities, the regimes that are backing the Arab Support Forces or the Sudanese Armed Forces, which have switched sides, you could say that maybe for the time being, the Arab Support Forces is backed by Russia, while the Sudanese Armed Forces is backed by Egypt. There are other players such as the United States or the United Arab Emirates, and all of these anti-democratic regimes that are backing our anti-democratic regime, to a far extent, are irrelevant to what is happening on the ground. As long as this support is happening, they are now continuing to. We are living under airstrikes under the attack, and I think what matters right now is a ceasefire on the ground. It does not matter if we're talking about whether they're going to go back to negotiations. I think there's a lot of talk in the international media and focus on the framework agreement. Honestly, when we hear that on the news, it just seems like our lives are irrelevant. Why are we focusing on an agreement that led us to the war when what should be the priority right now is a ceasefire, opening safe routes for people to be able to flee these active conflict zones right now. And what is written on paper right now does not matter when we have people under fire losing their lives.
What led to this latest outbreak of violence and a lot of attacks on military installations, but they're throughout Khartoum, so that, of course, threatens many civilians. Explain who these two forces are.
So the two forces are the Sudanese Armed Forces and the Rapid Support Forces, also known as the Janjaweed, which was legitimized by Omar al-Bashir's regime and further legitimized by the transitional government. For the Sudanese people, what matters is that this is an accumulation of what has happened during Omar al-Bashir's regime, what has happened during the transitional government, starting from the negotiations. It's an accumulation of allowing these forces to remain in power, to remain having arms, and to remain a legitimate entity in Sudan when the Sudanese people have been on the ground chanting the military back to its barricades, and the Janjaweed must be abolished.
And the revolt against Bashir was largely led by women. So what are you demanding happens right now?
The demands of all the Sudanese people is a ceasefire, opening safe routes, and most importantly, a lesson out of this that we cannot continue to legitimize these powers. We cannot continue to allow the Sudanese armed forces to be in the political scene. They need to return to their barricades, and we cannot continue to make little of the lives of the Sudanese people and the residents of Sudan.
So how do the civilians, how is civilian power achieved in Sudan right now, military leader?
Right now, what needs to happen is a ceasefire before anything else. What is happening on the ground, actually, is that the Sudanese people are the ones leading efforts that could have been expected from a government if we had a government that is actually interested in the well-being of the people. The civilians are the ones who are rescuing people who are trapped in risky zones. They are the ones who are, we are the ones who are creating makeshift ways of receiving and delivering medical attention. We are using our own personal vehicles to transport the injured and anyone who is in need of medical attention. And we are the ones who are coordinating the efforts of how to cope with the situation, how to cope with the power outages, with the water cuts. It is civilians who have returned to work during this time just for such emergencies such as water cuts and power outages. We are not receiving any help, whether from the government. We're not even receiving statements to clarify what is happening. All we're doing is guesswork from the ground. And we're not receiving any help from UN entities or international community. We are our own government right now helping ourselves and absolutely not paying attention to the statements of the government because they have been proved to be absolutely not credible.
Well, Marina El-Neil, we thank you so much for taking this time to speak to us. Sudanese activists currently in the capital, Khartoum. Please stay safe. We will continue to follow the story, of course. Next up, we go to a leading Ugandan LGBTQ activist who risked his life by traveling to the United States to speak out against a recently passed bill in Uganda that criminalizes anyone identifying as LGBTQ. Stay with us. And the New Batons. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn to Uganda, where lawmakers recently passed a sweeping new measure that makes it a crime to identify as LGBTQ and even allow for the death sentence in certain cases. The bill declares all same-sex conduct as non-consensual, makes it a crime to, quote, promote homosexuality, enforces all residents of Uganda, including family members and doctors, to report anyone who's in a same-sex relationship. Uganda's parliament passed the measure in March by a near-unanimous vote. The bill is now awaiting the signature of Uganda's president. Last week, I spoke to one of the leading LGBTQ activists in Uganda, Frank Mugisha, the executive director of Sexual Minorities Uganda. He was visiting Washington, D.C. I asked him to talk about the new legislation.
The legislation that has been passed by our parliament, that is pending the signature of the president, is one of the most extreme legislations, anti-gay legislations, to be passed in Africa. This legislation would compel any person who knows an LGBTQ person to report them to the authorities. A Catholic like myself, if I confess to my priest has to report me to the authorities. Any person who goes to seek treatment from a health practitioner, they would have to report them to the authority. This law further would criminalize any landlord who provides housing to an LGBTQ person. This law would outlaw the work I am doing on speaking out for LGBTQ persons, but also it would criminalize anything I post on my social media that advocates or promotes the human rights of LGBTQ persons. This This interview that I'm having now, if I had it in Uganda, the studio, the entity, myself would be criminalized. This legislation is here to erase the entire livelihood of the LGBTQ person in Uganda.
Where does the death penalty fit into this, Frank Mugisha?
The death penalty, first of all, it's important to note that the initial text of the bill did not have the death penalty. To show you how extreme the members of the Ugandan parliament are, the death penalty was introduced during the debate. The death penalty would criminalize any person who engages in sexual acts with a minor or if someone is in authority. But let us not confuse the death penalty for only punishing